Let's welcome John Valentine. Thank you.
Thank you all very much indeed. Thank you, Martin, for your generous words. It's really lovely to be back here. I said at the beginning when I spoke on Dostoevsky that what I can offer is not expertise. I'm not an expert on these things, but I can offer, I hope, lashings of enthusiasm. And at the end of the talk on Dostoevsky, this lovely lady came up to me. She was so charming and so delightful, and we chatted away over coffee. And then she said, have you read my book on Dostoevsky? I said, no. It was a bad moment, really. Yes, I've just started this PhD, which is a great, great treat, thinking about really John's Gospel and the work of James Joyce, not natural bedfellows, one would think, but really I think about how these two great writers think about the world, what they think reality is about, and how they communicate that through their use of language and symbol and so on. I can say after 5 weeks, all is going very well in the PhD, and I look forward to it continuing. Remaking the world. Remaking the world. Language, fiction, and reality in James Joyce's Ulysses. There's a lovely story about a man called Dr. Richard Best. And Richard Best, you'll remember if you've read Ulysses, he appears in the book. He is one of the librarians in Dublin's library. And there's a great long conversation between all these librarians and Stephen Dedalus, who is one of the heroes of Ulysses. When James Joyce died in 1941, the BBC decided to make a radio tribute programme about him. And they rang up Best and they said, would he take part in this programme? What makes you think I have any connection, he said, with this man, Joyce? The men for the BBC said, you can't deny it. You're a character in Ulysses. And apparently he took great exception to this. He said, I am not a character in fiction. I am a real human being. You can feel the sense of dudgeon in that, can't you? Well, it does raise for us the whole issue of reality and the novel Ulysses. Because Ulysses is presented to us as the, if you like, the most super-real novel of all time. You will know that it is the account of a single day in the city of Dublin, the 16th of June 1904. And in it we follow the days of Leopold Bloom, who's 38 years old, he's an advertising canvasser, and Stephen Dedalus, who's an aspiring writer, and towards the end, Molly Bloom, Leopold Bloom's wife, features very, very strongly. In a sense, I don't mean this rudely, nothing much happens. The high point of the novel is when these two men, they're absolutely dead tired. Stephen is definitely the worst for wear, and they sit down in Bloom's kitchen, and they talk about nothing very much, in a way. And that's the high point of the novel, at 2 a.m. at 7 Eccles Street, Dublin. And yet we see inside these two men in the most extraordinary ways. We see them as others see them throughout the novel, within the context of Dublin life, and through the eyes of other characters, particularly Bloom's wife Molly. At various stages we see them through their own fantasies, the projection of their own fantasies. We see them within the context of the national politics of the day. And we see them within the context of the cultural heritage in Ireland of the last 300 years and longer. And it's the most extraordinary writing. If you know the book, you'll know this. It's the most extraordinary writing. We experience not just their thoughts, but also their emotions and even their physical sensations. Ulysses is like a cubist painting. It turns its characters back to front and upside down and inside out, and it puts us right into the centre of their experience. So Ulysses is a representation of reality. Of reality as experienced, life as lived, of actually swimming in the tide of life, as Bloom puts it, rather than an artificial standing on a bank describing someone else swimming. Joyce at one point called his novel an encyclopedia. And he suggested that were Dublin to be flattened by bombs, it should be possible to reconstruct the city from the way it was described in Ulysses. He wrote the novel not living in Dublin, and he wrote to his favourite sister, Josephine, who was still living in Dublin, and he asked her to confirm for him various details of the layout of Dublin, such as if you're on this beach, could you see the spire of this church? And he asked her to check on the names of various shops and that sort of thing. Very, very particular. As with Richard Best, he used real people and real names in the novel. In fact, when it was published in Dublin, eventually, you will know that it took a long time to be published, the inhabitants of Dublin could be heard greeting one another in the street, saying, "Are you in it?" Someone has actually said that Joyce is perhaps more mimic than artist. A kind of hyper-real book. And yet it's a profoundly unrealistic book. For a start, it's called Ulysses. He takes Homer's Ulysses. He takes the great epic, which traces the return of the hero back to his wife Penelope after the Trojan War. And Joyce went to great lengths to make sure that we, the reading public, would know that Ulysses is very, very artfully patterned on various incidents and adventures in Homer's Odyssey. In fact, each episode of Joyce's Ulysses is part of a complex pattern. Each one has a style, it has a time of day, it even has an organ of the body. And when we read the novel, we find that Bloom in particular is constantly presented to us in the guise of some heroic figure of the past. For instance, Elijah, or Shakespeare, or Christ, as well as Odysseus, Ulysses. But the most striking feature of the novel is, of course, its language, its style, actually its styles. Each episode is written in a different way. So, for instance, the episode set outside the office of the editor of a Dublin newspaper is written in the style of newspaper headlines and then newspaper articles. Another episode is written in the style of a woman's magazine and Christian devotional literature. Another is written as a play, as if it's written by Strindberg. And another episode is a real tour de force, a mélange of literary styles from Anglo-Saxon to the present day. And Joyce actually went so far as to say that the style of the novel is actually its subject. So what we have is a kind of hyper-realism on the one hand, but treated in a markedly unrealistic way on another. We have an intense concentration on actual ordinary experience, narrated in a fashion which self-consciously announces itself as extraordinary. This is a novel which is about what it is to be human, and it insists that how we think and talk about being human is a crucial element to that very humanity. Joyce is telling us that we can't separate the living of our lives from the way we think about our lives. And for that we need a whole range of interpretive devices, and the greatest one is language. How we talk about our lives is part and parcel of what our lives are and can become, he suggests to us. And I think it's important to note when Joyce wrote Ulysses. The last line of the novel masquerades as the places and dates of its composition. Not masquerades, this is where it was written. In Trieste, Zurich and Paris, 1914 to 1921. And Tom Stoppard has a marvellous scene in his play, Travesties, in which I think it's Lenin and Tristan Tzara and James Joyce, they're sitting talking in a cafe. And Joyce is asked, what did he do during the Great War? Why, he says, I wrote Ulysses. Now it's a good gag, it's a good joke, but it's also profoundly true, because Ulysses was written against the backcloth of the First World War, the first global conflict, which cost thousands of lives and inflicted terrible horrors on the world. And Joyce was finding a way of being human that had no space for war. He wanted to create a way of living, to show a way of living, which would ensure that this never happened again. He wanted no truck with war, with imperialism, with violence. And he expressed this desire through his celebration of the ordinary, unexceptional people doing unexceptional things. But he also expressed it through painting these very ordinary people and their lives as genuinely heroic. So Leopold Bloom is the new Ulysses. Stephen Dedalus is on a scale with Hamlet. Molly Bloom is a kind of new Penelope. And Joyce's struggle, and I think his brilliance, was to find a way of making the ordinary valuable and significant, and without forcing it into the very categories that all around the world had led to war. Now, it fascinates me that at the same time as Joyce was writing Ulysses, a young Swiss pastor called Karl Barth was working on his monumental commentary on the book of Romans in the Bible, St. Paul's letter to the Romans. And Barth, as you know, would go on to become one of the most significant theologians of the 20th century. But at the time, he was an ordinary pastor of a church in Switzerland. He had been profoundly affected by the horrors of war. And his response was to find expression in his great commentary on Romans of 1922, when it was published. And that was to repudiate the so-called natural law approach to theology. Barth saw the horrors of war as the full stop of all attempts by human beings to construct their own theology, to argue their way to God through their own insight, analogies, and deductions from the world around them. All that could be read off the world, said Barth, was death. And Barth argued that what humanity needed was a word from outside into our world, a revelation that came from God into the world. And this revelation, said Barth, was Jesus Christ. The word of Jesus was Barth's message for a world that had all but destroyed itself in war and conflict. Now Joyce, too, I think, is looking for a word of hope for a world that has all but destroyed itself. Stephen Dedalus talks about history as a nightmare from which he wishes to awake. And Bloom declares that he believes in love because it's the opposite of hatred. There's a great speech. Bloom is terrible at making speeches. It's one of the jokes of the book. He can't tell jokes. He can't make speeches. He can never make himself heard. So this is his longest speech, one of his longest speeches in the novel. And he says, force, hatred, history, all that, that's not life for men and women, insult and hatred. And everybody knows that it's the very opposite of that that is really life. Love, says Bloom, I mean the opposite of hatred. And this message of love is shown in the gentle acts of kindness that Bloom does throughout the novel. He's always kind to animals. He helps a blind man across a busy street. He refuses to let hatred into his heart at his wife's betrayals. And at one point, Stephen is knocked down by a British soldier in a drunken brawl. And it's Bloom, in Joyce called it Orthodox Samaritan fashion, who picks him up and looks after him. Bloom is the kind man. He's the outsider, of course. He's the outsider. He's the Jew. It's very important for Joyce that Bloom was Jewish. He's the exile. He lives a life of heroism for the modern world. But how to express that? If we need words, language to live, then which words, which language can we use without slipping back into the rhetoric of empire, of violence, and oppression? And I think, like Barth, Joyce is all the time reaching for the word from outside, the word of Jesus. Unlike Barth, Joyce finds that he cannot use the word of Jesus without ambiguity. And the reason for that is that Joyce grew up in Catholic Ireland at the end of the 19th century and broke decisively with the Catholic Church at that time. That was his background. He went to Catholic schools and a Catholic university. He thought for a while he was being called to be a priest. You'll know all this from the portrait of the artist as a young man. But he found that his sexual life put him at variance with the church and its teaching. And he found that Catholic Ireland was smothering him. So when he left Dublin for good in 1904, he returned just twice, I think, in the rest of his life. He did so to escape two tyrannies, twin tyrannies as he understood them, the tyranny of the Catholic Church and the tyranny of the British Empire. And he did so to find freedom, artistic and sexual freedom. He wrote to Nora, his girlfriend, who was to become his lifelong companion, that from then on he was going to make, quote, open war on the Catholic Church by what I write and say and do, hating it most fervently. And there's no reason to doubt what he said. But equally, and I don't want to make Joyce out to be some kind of undercover Jesuit writer, his view of the world remained, I think, in large part Christian. At its most fundamental, Joyce saw reality as joined up, as connected. Where previously he would have said with Barth that that connection had a name, Jesus Christ, in Ulysses and throughout his life he struggled to define and express the meaning of meaning in life. Eric Auerbach, another name. Eric Auerbach wrote his hugely influential book on Western culture called Mimesis in Istanbul between 1942 and 1945. Very interesting, there's another hugely significant book written during a time of war. And Auerbach's central thesis, as I understand it, is that one can trace great Western writing as being essentially mimetic, imitative of life. It constructs its own symbolic and interpretive life over the centuries as its way of seeking to understand and express the mysteries of existence. And I think that Joyce would agree with that. Ulysses cannibalizes the Western canon beautifully, along with newspaper adverts, magazines, barroom songs, opera, cheap literature, street slang. But for all the purpura effects of Ulysses, it's by the great landmarks that Joyce steers. Aristotle, Plato, Aquinas, Shakespeare. He looks to these as the starting point for understanding reality and art, as understanding how we see, how we create. He may not stay with them, that's for sure, but he starts with them, I would argue. And it's against them that he spars with Freud and Jung. And behind them all stands the Christian metaphysic, especially the figures of Elijah and Christ. Now, if Auerbach was arguing that art does not create but imitates reality, could one see in Ulysses a comparable thesis that behind reality, with all its complexity and unreadability, one could trace the repeated outline of the self-sacrifice of God? For Joyce, although God was somehow inadmissible as an interpretation of reality, the presence of Jesus was inextinguishable. And one sees this in things like the power of weakness in Ulysses. One sees this in the way that love is privileged. One sees this in the way that the life and death of Christ is the paradigm for the great acts of the novel. Stephen is beaten to the ground as Christ was beaten. Bloom is betrayed as Christ was betrayed. And the virtues that the novel offers us, and it does, it's a highly moralistic even book. It says some things are better than others. And the virtues that the novel offers us are Christ-like. Humility, forgiveness, self-sacrifice, love. And these abstract qualities find concrete expression over against force and hatred and cruelty. It is Jesus only who can be trusted not to usurp power or turn to violence. Where irony and humour abound in the book, they act as a kind of index of authenticity for Christ. Just like the novel's heroes, Christ is an outsider, always mocked and ridiculed. Yet in the book we learn to read exclusion as exaltation. The true heroes are not Homeric, they're men of blood. Joyce was a lifelong pacifist, he couldn't stand killing. And Ulysses stands against bloodshed. So true heroes, they're not Homeric. Even Ulysses, Odysseus, went round killing people. The end of the Odyssey, as you know, is a bloodbath. And Joyce will not affirm that in any way. True heroes, they're not Shakespearean, even though there's a huge reverence for Shakespeare in this book, because Shakespearean heroes are cruel. Hamlet ends up slaying all the people that are left on the stage at the time. Shakespeare himself, in the library episode, there's a long dissertation on this. Shakespeare himself was cruel to Anne Hathaway and left him famously in his will his second best bed. What's going on there? The true heroes, they're not the political heroes, even of nationalist Ireland, like Daniel O'Connell, the liberator, or Charles Stuart Parnell, the chief. They prove to have feet of clay. No, the true hero of the novel is the Christ hero with his word of love. And this is the foundational reality of Ulysses. The hyper-reality of a novel that is written during a time of war but doesn't really mention war. Obliquely it's saying, only love will do. And only in Christ can the necessary love ultimately be found. And this finds expression not religiously, but in the fleshed out lives of its characters. So if we are not to be crushed, consumed by power and cruelty, then we must find love and life, forgiveness, kindness and self-sacrifice, or life will be unlivable, irredeemable. And even in his absence, if we can say this, Jesus is powerfully present in the novel. Joyce, as it were, gives us a compendium of Auerbach and Barthes. We have a word from God that must, of necessity, find constant emulation in contemporary life. But how are we to talk of such a reality? If how we talk about life is part and parcel of life, what words can we use? What language can we employ? Particularly when we need to eschew the old words of power and might, the twin tyrannies of church and empire. A new mode of discourse must be found, so language is let off its leash. Joyce ransacks the diction of the past and the present, the cultured and the popular. If how we talk about life is integral to the experience of life, if words are what make us human, then it is in language as well as action that we shall find meaning. So we say, do we find Barthes' word of Jesus Christ in the language of Ulysses, just as we do in its mythical mimesis? And I'm not sure that we do. I'm not sure that we do. The language of faith doesn't hold up for Joyce. The Latin of the various services that Bloom goes to or that reverberate through Stephen's mind, it's either a narcotic or it's a gesture of exclusion. And Jesus himself in the novel is silent, at least verbally. Love may be powerfully expressive in action, but it's dumb in word. Now, what do we say about this? Nietzsche once argued that we could never get rid of God as long as we still believe in grammar. It's very interesting, isn't it? We can never get rid of God as long as we still believe in grammar. And by contrast, George Steiner has argued that the very existence of words and language is a wager on transcendence. Now, if I understand those two great thinkers correctly, I wonder if Ulysses embraces both those observations. With no God language, or at least with no diction adequate to conveying the divine self-giving of Christ, then there's a kind of linguistic vacuum at the heart of all human discourse. So we can read Ulysses as a manic attempt to create human linguistic community sufficient to bear the weight of human experience. The very exuberance of the styles of language in Ulysses bears witness not just to the power of language to create worlds of meaning, but rather to its inadequacy. Without words to communicate the Barthian word, communication itself becomes a frantic exercise in finding a way of experiencing reality and expressing it. And rather than saying nothing, we find ourselves saying anything at all. And I think we do see that in some episodes of the book. In some episodes, language kind of gets out of hand. It's too much. It takes over. It's always beautiful, it's always creative, it's never less than fun and hilarious. But there are times when language is devious and deceitful. It can be sentimental. There's a kind of sentimentality which is actually not true. And Joyce revolts against that. or language just runs away with itself. In the great Oxen of the Sun episode, the great one of world literature, there are different sections representing great writers throughout the ages, and it's almost as if that it's too much, and we end up by saying so much by saying so little. So is Ulysses, in a sense, a frantic attempt to create language sufficient to bear human experience? When we can no longer talk about Jesus, how can we use language? It's almost as if the novel collapses in on itself and then retreats from that and ends powerfully with Molly's soliloquy, which restores human discourse to a kind of equality with human experience that had been lost before. None of which is to say that Joyce is reluctant to affirm the power of words and the validity of language. The sheer delight in words, the copious analysis of literature, the elusive quality of so much of the writing, the way that various motifs and quotations are carried throughout the book, the way single words are made to trigger memories or become character signatures, it's just amazing. It's wonderful, wonderful stuff. And none of that would be possible without a faith in language, that it really does communicate. In Steiner's terminology, this is a wager on the meaning of meaning, which Steiner traces to what he calls the necessary possibility of the existence of God. The universality of linguistic communication implies a frame of reference that is, by definition, greater than even the sum of humanity. This is not the same as Barthes' word of Jesus Christ, but it is a kind of super word that lies within the heart of God as much as it does within the heart of humanity. Now, one senses Joyce's ambivalence about these things. His hostility to the church, it's clear and it's explicit, and he means it. But his tenderness towards Christ is more subtle and more latent than on the surface, but it's nonetheless present. But this would be of a piece with its subject. A crusading Christ would be no Christ at all in Joycean terms. So to finish with, I think at the very least in Ulysses, James Joyce asks us to believe. He asks us to believe in a reality that is greater than war and empire and hatred. A reality in which the everyday can be heroic and the ordinary can be noble. And to do that, he gives us a wonderful world that is remade through myth and language. Remade, not made. It's recycled. It's rendered mimetically. It's not created ex nihilo. This is a reality he suggests that we can affirm and celebrate even in the face of tragedy and horror. And I would suggest, greatly daring, that he can do so because the underlying reality, endlessly imitated, emulated, and lived out every day and in every place, is the reality of the word. That word seen most clearly in Jesus Christ. That word known to all men. The word of love. Thank you.
Well, I hope we can have a bit of a discussion, and if you have comments or questions, let's open it to the floor. Thank you, John. Right, Ian, there's a mic coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want some clarification really on how Joyce understood Christ. Is Christ understood as a kind of ideal who doesn't really exist? Or is Christ seen as what the church really ought to have been and sort of does exist? I mean, what's his kind of relationship? I'm not quite clear whether he's just embarking on a great leap of faith,
yes,
saying we must somehow believe in what language can do for us, because we've got this kind of momentum of Western culture behind us that has
yes.
spoken us good things.
Yes, yes.
And we have to be very critical of it. Is he saying that? I'm not quite clear.
No, thank you. It's such a good question, and forgive me, the ambiguity is mine. But I think it's partly Joyce's ambiguity as well. He is very clear in the ideal of Jesus, I think.
Explicitly?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's part of him that always loved Jesus. And even when he was, fiercely anti-Christian, and there are lovely tales of him wandering around the churches of Trieste in Holy Week and just absolutely loving the services. But he hated the church, he hated the priests, he hated Christian morality, he hated all that. But I think he is clear on Jesus, because Jesus is the only one that can be trusted with violence and power. He sees the church as subverting that and as kind of capturing that and using a borrowed power, which Jesus never borrowed. That's what he loves in Jesus, is the humility, the self-sacrifice, and so on. Now, there are a couple of crossovers. The first is that this was the time of the great debates about the historicity of Jesus and the Christian faith. And that is explicitly alluded to in Ulysses. Was Jesus a historical figure? And I think the answer is yes. And I think Joyce does as well. But there's always an ambiguity, a kind of reluctance to push the consequences of that. For instance, in the funeral scene, the Hades episode, there's a lot of discussion about the resurrection, and is the resurrection of Jesus a myth or is it a reality? And as always with Joyce, when you get to the nitty gritty, there's a joke about it. And there's this great joke about Jesus calling forth Lazarus and saying, "Lazarus, come forth!" And the gravedigger says, "Oh, he missed it, he only came fifth and lost the job." That's just typical. But underneath that, there's a sense of, well, did Lazarus come forth? And if Lazarus did come forth, what does that mean for Paddy Dignam? Will he live again? And that comes out later on in the novel as well, when there's this outpouring of anger against Jesus because he let Paddy Dignam die. And there's real anger. But to have that kind of real anger, who's that anger directed against? So I think your question goes right to the heart of huge ambiguities within Joyce and within the thought of both theology at the time and the whole of Western culture. Thank you.
Brown,
yes.
If I've understood this correctly, John, again, and I enjoy it so much, what you said, very ignorant of Jeff Joyce, but if he has lost the metaphysic,
yes.
If his rejection of the church also includes a rejection of the Christian view of reality, if that is the case, and he's trying to hang on to this very precious thing, the word,
yes.
and quite vital stuff,
yes.
Could you say something about the trajectory that came out of Joyce? Because I understand it had a tremendous influence on all that followed.
Yes.
And kind of like the equivalents in art and music and so on. Those who were really great, but were great more from the memory of what they were rejecting than great because of what they were actually saying. And it's this trajectory
that
comes out of.
Yeah.
Because I think what follows, as I understand it, is that you actually lose narrative completely, you lose any idea of meaning.
Yes.
And tremendously, I'm thinking of Sam Beckett in particular, also left out of So if you could say something about that, because it really troubles me.
Yes.
Because one admires his what he's believing in.
Yes.
But because it has no connection with the metaphysics. It seems to me it just has to just sort of...
Yes.
Thank you. Into the
That's a great question. I'm not sure I know enough to pontificate, but it's never stopped me before. So I'll have a go. Interestingly, what comes after Ulysses is Finnegan's Wake, and Finnegan's Wake is I think much more open to other religious expressions and. Even in Ulysses, there's quite a lot of discussion about metempsychosis and the transmigration of souls, and you know, try to think, well, if not Christ, then what? So I think there's a real sense if you stop believing this, then what do you believe in? And I think there is a desperation, not just in the language, but in the metaphysics of Finnegan's Wake as well. But interestingly, I think. Beckett broke with Joyce, not personally. I mean, they knew each other very, very well, as you know. And indeed, Beckett went out with Joyce's daughter for quite some time, though it ended unhappily. But Beckett is, as I understand it, I'm no expert again, is kind of brutal in his atheism. There is no God, so we live in an empty universe. But the absence is powerful and deafening, and still defines the way we think about the world. I think Joyce is wanting to say, I'm not going that far. I'm really not going that far. I think for Joyce it's about morality rather than about doctrine, in a way.
But is that good or bad? From the Christian point of view,
yes.
We're glad that he is affirming morality.
Yes. He's not. He's rejecting morality.
Pardon?
He's rejecting morality.
Sorry.
Ulysses. Yeah.
But his desire for love.
Yes.
To predominate.
Yes.
I mean, that's what I meant.
Yes, I'm with you. I'm with you. I mean, he is still frantically, I think, trying to hang on to Jesus and love and the connection that go together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why Ulysses is such an immensely positive book. I mean, it's funny, it's amusing, and you know, famously, the last word is yes. And Joyce was very, very clear, the last word had to be the most positive word in the language. Yes, you can believe in life because you can believe in... and that's behind your question. Yeah, but what happens after that? And... I think in terms of literature what happens is that interiority just takes over massively. Subjectivity is it. Jung and Freud are knocking at the door very, very loudly. Joyce read everything that they wrote, really didn't like them, largely because of his daughter who had mental issues, and Jung offered to treat her, I think it's his right, and he would not have. He called them the Austrian Tweedledum and Tweedledee. He did not want them near his daughter. But you can tell that, you know, interiority is coming. Subjectivity is it. And I think that, as I understand it, that's the road that literature and culture went down, was the subjective as being the only thing that you could know. You cannot know anything objective anymore. And perhaps there is a reaction against that now, and again, I really don't understand this, and please, if others do, it would be very interesting to pursue this. And the way the French literary critics have gone, looking for, you know, meaning in the structures of words, then that is the way forward to rescue meaning. There is a subliminal meaning in the language itself, even if there is not in the way that we use it. Roland Barthes said very, very interestingly that once we lose the author, and many people said that in Joyce we have lost the author now, the novel has taken over, but if you lose the author, then we have the birth of the reader. So we are bringing our meaning into Ulysses and into Finnegan's Wake, and what we believe is what is. So, I mean, it's such an interesting question. But I think one is then into the worlds of subjectivity and different understandings of knowledge, really, and experience. And does anyone know more about that? I have pontificated from a position of total ignorance.
It's impressive, totally.
And any other questions?
Well, this is just a very just occurs to me in the light of what you just said, I wonder whether one way of organising one's reflections on James Joyce is to say that it is a prolonged struggle between idealism and scepticism.
Discuss. Idealism and scepticism. Can I just add a little something in there? I know what you mean. Why is the body so important for Joyce? Because for him, reality was, it was never enough just to think about it. I mean, there's this very, very famous scene at the beginning, near the beginning of the novel, where Stephen walks along the beach, and he is the philosopher par excellence, and he closes his eyes and says, "Am I walking into eternity on stranded Mount Sand?" And you know, there's lots of jokes about Berkeley that, you know, if you can't see it, it's not there. But then, what about Aristotle bumping his head on something and thinking, "Oh, it's there"? And then, what came first? Was it the colours or was it the structures of things? And I mean, it's ever so interesting. But Joyce takes the mickey mercilessly out of Stephen and just said, "Come on, lad, get a life. You know, get a girlfriend." I think there's a lot of that in this. He's very impatient on philosophizing, and this is why each episode has the body. And I think where he's going is that if I don't know what to believe anymore, then at least I can still feel. You know, the body is there, and you can trust the sensation of eating and seeing and, you know, embracing. All these sorts of things are real. Perhaps in a way that everything else isn't. But then he's still, this is your idealism point, he still wants to say, but people are killing themselves all around Europe for ideals. He hates ideals. And in his life it was the same. When he became famous, Irish artist, forgive me, I'm going to pronounce this wrongly, Patrick Toohey, I think his name was, he came, and he said to Joyce, "I want to capture your soul." And Joyce said, "Just make sure you get my tie right." You know, he can't bear this kind of airy-fairy stuff, you know, it's what you see in it. It's kind of life as lived, that's what really mattered to him.
Yes, come back. I'm labouring under the the absence of having read Joyce, but from what you've described, it sounds as though he's a man who, in the midst of the carnage of the First World War, in the midst of this disappointment, in a sense, with some aspects of his own upbringing, there's a longing for human potential, that if we loved as we might, perhaps one might say, if we experienced as we can, that would be good.
Do you want to add up?
Sure. Again, the things that you just said, they're disturbing very much also, because while he isn't able in himself to affirm the physical,
yes.
You know, having rejected, I'm just using this my terminology, having rejected the physical, yes. And sort of philosophizing.
Yes.
It's a very short distance between him and then the collapse of any, you know, idea in the sense of what he is confirming, you know, that what happens to me. And I do see that there is good, and we should be imitating Jesus, etc., etc.
Yes.
So this troubles me enormously. I don't know if you feel my point. But he is able to affirm it himself. He has nothing within which to sort of locate it, and hence. It's a wonderful gesture that he's making, and we would say, you know, it's a correct affirmation. But because he has no foundation, it's kind of like Jesus' image.
Yes.
The last book on Sabbath is going to collapse when the rain comes.
Yeah.
And you don't seem to be, as I've understood, you feel like this affirmation is something positive.
Yeah.
And I'm halfway there with you.
Yes.
But then I'm going to say, hang on, but look, if you do develop in our sense, the Christian worldview, God, that Jesus really is the same.
Yes.
But because he is the creator.
Yes.
Yes. And there is a moral action, etc. Because of all that, then it all does mean something. But
yes.
It's his friend.
Yes.
He can't mean anything.
Yeah.
So it seems like a desperate hanging on to something which you can't really hang on to.
I think he feels that there's a gentleman at the back I'd love to hear from as well. Absolutely. I mean, if I get beyond week five of my PhD, I want to compare Joyce to John's Gospel and the notion then of the Word. Now the word comes quite often in Ulysses, which is quite interesting. You know, the Word known to all men. comes the Word known to all men is a direct quote. It comes two or three times, capital W, and he keeps saying it's love, he takes the Mickey as well. You know, in the Oxford of the Sun, you know, the word, and it comes out Burke's, which is the name of a pub, and off go the medics. They go to the pub, so the Word becomes the pub. But as always for Joyce, it's funny, but it's serious as well. He's saying, we are, you know, earlier on Stephen talks about God is a shout in the street. And by that, I think he's saying there is, and I think this is where I think he's stronger than just an idealist who's lost touch. I think he feels that there is a connection, there is connectedness. And I think you and I would say, you know, the Word is Jesus.
Yes.
And for various reasons which one understands, Joyce cannot say it's Jesus. He can't go with Bart and say it's Jesus. But I think, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting him, I think I would want to say, come on, Jim, come on, have the courage of your convictions. Sam, go for it.
I think to add to that, I think maybe in another life, Joyce must have been quite a fair Christian.
Yes.
But growing up, I think, into 19th century Catholic Ireland, I think what particularly turned him off was the social element and the catechism and the ritual. And so when he cast that off, because he was a very proud, arrogant person, I think he probably wouldn't allow himself to go back to even some of it. It had to be all or nothing. And he cast the church off at quite a young age, and he just couldn't go back, couldn't allow himself to go back to any of it because of how he felt the church is sucking the life out of the country and his mind.
Yes.
I think the scene in Portrait, when he finally does reject the church.
Yes.
And all those, when he's talking about the priests, all of them is the death, and the rope and the priest's waist is like a noose, it's a skull in the chest. And that's how he saw the church as a vampire.
Yes.
So to allow himself to even go back to some of
their beliefs,
just
yes.
You could never do it.
Yes. That's really helpful. So it's a sort of personal, sort of psychological rejection, isn't it, from his own experience. But I think the structures are still there. I do you agree? I think that's sort of how he thought. And he never repudiated that, or at least he never lost that, even though he wouldn't name it. In that way. No, there's too much at stake. Yes, yes. Thank you very much. How interesting. Yeah.
Just ask a little bit about Joyce's attitude to sexuality.
Yes.
You say he's emphasize the physical, you know,
yes.
Give life to the ultimate. And then one of the reasons he gave up being a Christian was because it was so constrictive and repressive, as he felt it. Did he have any doubts about sexuality as being kind of authenticating? Or was he a true believer, an early 20th 19th century sort of true believer in the kind of redemptive or sanctification effect of sexuality. Did you see what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
And if so, what would you say?
I think he was he was a true believer in the redemptive power of sexuality. He, maybe not redemptive, but expressive. That was who he was. So, you know, he, I don't want to offend anyone, but you know, very early on he went with prostitutes, and that was the break with the Catholic Church. And why he loved Nora so completely and passionately within their first meeting was that he saw in her someone who was perhaps socially shy but sexually bold, and right from the very start he knew, and he wrote the most amazing letters to her, which were, you know, fantastically erotic, and right from the very very beginning, and I don't think that ever stopped. And but what, where his, I think where there's a really interesting struggle is around the whole area of betrayal. Because as well as being a very passionate, physical man, he was immensely jealous. Immensely jealous. And you know, there are a couple of occasions when he thought Nora had gone with other men, and he really was nearly destroyed by this. But what is so extraordinary was Joyce would almost kind of create those situations. He would push men towards her and leave them alone and almost kind of try and create it. And was that a test? Was it not a test? And, you know, one could say that Ulysses, the novel, is about betrayal. In a way, the only things that happen are that there's a fight outside a pub and Bloom's wife, Molly, commits adultery with this man, Blaise's boyman. And that we never see that, but it's everywhere. It's absolutely everywhere. So Bloom knows it's going to happen at 4:30 that afternoon. And, you know, throughout the novel, there are little hints about, you know, where are they now? Oh, blimey, I've just seen Boynum. And, you know, there's a straw hat. Boynum wears a straw hat. And so the whole novel is shot through with this dreadful, dreadful pain. But it's almost as if Joyce is saying, what I want in my hero is someone whose wife can commit adultery and he can still love her and forgive and be embraced and accepted. So there's this extraordinary kind of duality about kind of believing passionately in sex as sex, quite apart from any kind of moral constraint, but also on the other hand struggling with it, this whole notion of betrayal. But if one believes in betrayal, then does one believe in faithfulness? And so it's an interesting one. Mm. On that note, is it time to gratefully have another coffee?
Sure, we can go on, but I guess we may have explored all those themes. It's been a really, really fascinating evening. John, we hope you'll come back perhaps when you're further on your PhD.
It's been a really
interesting evening, and you've really opened our minds tonight. So thank you very, very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.